Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 27th, 2001. In the Creekside room this morning is Steve Gramsch. Today's session number is GRS 2001-05, and it's titled Faith and Science, a Resolution for the Christian. Let's listen in.
Equation is so complicated, it can still be solved by very direct techniques of pure mathematics. And so that's really the point that I wanted to make, that this pure mathematics is the root of the solution to this physical problem. I think the amazing thing is that when you think about the periodic table and you look at the simplicity of this model, which is simply the hydrogen atom, the most abundant element in the universe, actually, we find that this basic solution and all of its sort of implications that follow directly from this pure mathematics that I talked about can be applied to all the elements in the periodic table, which means that this very, very simple model is the basic model for all of the atoms and their much more difficult complexities that we run into further on down the line.
I have a question. In what sense do you say that the solution is mathematical? Because as I recall the history of the derivation of that equation, that guy Schrödinger, he actually thought of another equation first and rejected it because he couldn't see how it would match the experiment. And so the selection of the equation, I mean, that has a lot of input from experiment.
Yeah, right. What I'm saying here is not inconsistent with that. What I'm saying here is that there is a physical, what he rejected was a physical model that ultimately wound up in an equation that he rejected. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the physical model, the physical reality that he tried to match with experiment, wound up in the basic physics that found its expression in this different equation. And then that equation, my point was that that equation can be solved. It's purely mathematical technique. It's a basic, what we call a differential equation, that is solved straightforwardly. The interesting thing, and I'll move on from this because it's not really the point, but the interesting thing about this is that the hydrogen atom problem contains one particle here and one particle here, and they're moving mutually. It is the only problem that can be solved exactly. Every other problem, if you talk about sodium atoms, for example, cannot be solved exactly. This is the only one that can be solved exactly, and the solutions that are precisely known, we say that it can be solved in closed form. Anyway, which again, points to the complexity of the periodic table. But today, what I want to do is, based on the things that we've talked about for the past 4 days, is to try to come to some sort of a resolution about how we as people of, in our case, the Christian faith, but people of faith in general, would articulate what our beliefs are. And I think that's a challenging aspect of the problem. And one of the reasons, I think will become very clear in the end when we get to the end of this discussion today. But the point, I think, is that I think that the community of faith needs to have a voice in this issue. And what I'd like to do is run through a little bit about the creationism debate. Are most people familiar with what this debate, the kind of premises that are involved in it? I'll run through some of them just briefly, but premise one in this is that the Bible can be taken literally as a scientific text. That's their first premise. Now, the creationism debate, as we've talked about before, tries to fit the prevailing scientific data to the Bible as its scientific text, to work sort of in reverse of what the normal scientific procedure is. The normal scientific procedure says, okay, there's data out there, and that we will try to come to some conclusion about what that means. The creationism debate actually works the other way. It says, here is the final conclusion. God created the earth in 7 days, and there was a flood that lasted a year, and all these other sorts of facts that are found. And what the idea is to take the existing scientific data and use them to prove this final conclusion. And anybody who's done any scientific work at all, I think, will immediately find problems with that. But let's take a look at the reasons why. First of all, the reason that the Bible is the scientific text in this case is because God holds all truth. There is no truth that can exist that does not come from God. Now, if the Bible is the Word of God, then that must hold all the truth. Now, that, to our way of thinking, may seem like fuzzy logic, but to them, it's not.
Is that actually the claim? Is it the claim that the Bible holds all the truth, or simply that all that is in the Bible is true?
Well, that's a good point. It's, I think, a mixture of the two. I think your latter, or your first statement, the one that everything in the Bible is true, or that was your second statement.
Right.
It was the second statement. The one that everything in the Bible is true, yes. But the fact that within these matters, the Bible does hold the truth. Whatever is said in the Bible can be taken as scientific fact. So I think it's a combination of both. Would you agree?
No.
Why not?
It is true, and I think any creationist would agree, that there's a blackboard over there in the front of the room. And that is a true statement, and it is not in the Bible. And therefore, all of the things that are true are not in the Bible.
Ah, okay. I guess I see what you mean. I'm taking a more restricted view of my first statement.
Okay.
Right. I'm not sort of venturing into the philosophical. But you're absolutely right. Anyway, that the creation science, of course, is not really science at all, and we've addressed that fact. Now, for those of you who are not aware of this, there's an outfit called the Institute for Creation Research, and it was founded by three gentlemen with degrees in geology or scientific disciplines to geology, one mechanical engineering, I think, from well-respected universities. Now, these people decided to found this institute, and what they did was they induced bright young students that were evangelically minded to pursue graduate study in geology with the idea that then they would come and join the fold, and they would sort of produce a sort of a critical mass, if you will, of people to go out and then put forth this version of the creation story with their geology. It's very interesting, I think, and instructive, that many of these actually deserted the faith, or deserted the cause, I guess you would call it, once they got into their graduate study. They got into it and realized that this really was not consistent. I mean, their graduate study, their training, their accumulation of knowledge and experience were not consistent with what they were going there to try to prove, I guess you would say. Again, it works sort of back the other way. But there's several people that actually have managed to hold on to this faith despite their graduate training, and then finally have gone ahead and led the creationist movement. Now, this actually, I think probably makes a very good story. It's well documented in a book called The Creationists. What happened to these young people once they got into graduate study and realized that they were sort of barking up the wrong tree. But anyway, what I want to do is just briefly talk a little bit about this creationist timetable. it's actually pretty instructive. According to the creationists, and they have an exact date for this, by the way, exact year, I mean, not a day of the week or anything like that, but according to them, it starts in 4000 BC with Creation Week. And the Creation Week, of course, naturally, is what we have read in the Bible. In day one, the light and the dark and the earth itself are created. Day two, the waters above and the waters below. Day three, the earth's crust and the plants. Day four, the sun, moon, and the stars. Day five, atmosphere, water, animals. Day six, land animals and Adam and Eve. And seventh day, of course, is a day of rest. But according to this now, you have in the 1500 years between the creation, this 1 week of creation, and what we call the flood year. And so the flood year is about 2500 BC. And so according to the pre-flood geology, then there's a few things that we need to pay attention to. First, the world's waters, all of the water in the earth, is in a Venus-like atmosphere, or groundwater, one or the other. There's either this big, huge cloud, or it's all this water is stored in the earth. The human life spans an average of 900 years during that time. During this time, the speed of light has changed. So it's not the same, and so that makes, from one point to the other, so that makes radio dating methods that are well proven to be very accurate. These are, of course, invalid. And finally, one of the more interesting ones is that the battle of Satan and the angels produces the craters on the moon. And believe it or not, that is a definite part of their scientific.
So by creationist here, you're explicitly excluding groups of people such as Tony Evans and those who would argue for a time scale on the order of tens of thousands of years, but not precisely 4,000.
Right. This is a very localized group.
It's a very specific subset.
Right. It is a subset of the broader, what we might call young Earth group. Young Earth meaning people who believe that the Earth is less than about 4 billion years old, which is what the scientific record tends to show us. So anyway, you had a year here at 2500 BC that has a number of very interesting aspects to it, and I'll just briefly mention these too. You have 40 days of rain, which is okay. The main flood period lasts about 250 days. And finally, you have about 100 days of the flood retreating. Now, the flood geology that takes place within the time span of this 1 year has the following characteristics. First of all, the large animals run to the mountaintops, but not a single human is caught in this early flood sediments. The dinosaurs are washed off in the middle of the flood. The mile-thick Utah salt beds, we know of those geologically in that area of the country, formed by massive evaporation of seawater during the flood. Now, coral reefs are now growing to thicknesses of a fifth of a mile or 2/10 of a mile, at 40,000 times the rate that we have observed currently in the world that the coral reefs grow. 40,000 times the rate. In the Yellowstone area of this country, in this area, 10 to 27, the number's a little bit fuzzy, but 10 to 27 mature forests, large forests, are covered by ash and then regrown on top of each other within the period of 1 year. Continental drift, the motion of the continents, occurs at about 2 to 5 miles per hour. I think that's a little bit rapid, given that what we're seeing right now out there. Deep sea sediments of an average of about 1,500 feet collect on these new ocean floors. The volcano of Mount Ararat now builds 7,000 feet high underwater and then cools so that the Ark can land on top. And this is, I think, the coup de grace here. The Grand Canyon is cut by receding floodwaters, not by a river, but by receding floodwaters, and the mile-high sediments harden into mile-high cliffs at roughly 1 meter per day. So, very quickly rising into the cliffs that we see, the sediments laid down in the Grand Canyon. I mean, if you go there, you see these beautiful bands of sedimentary rocks that, according to all laws of physical science, to get those from the sediments that were laid down would certainly not happen in 1 year, but probably take several million years to harden into the sediments that are there. Now, that's just a thumbnail sketch, but I think what I want you to understand about this is that this really requires a suspension of all known scientific principles. To adopt this basically requires that we just chuck the science that we know out the window.
But the basic you do that principles. Already at 4,000 BC?
Pardon me?
Didn't you do that already at 4,000 BC? I mean, well, what you have to have say here is that this doesn't follow regular physical laws. You must say the Earth was reformed in a miraculous way. But you've already done that previously.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess I'm emphasizing it here as kind of something that's a little bit more, shall we say, obviously out of whack. But anyway, the final thing is that we have now a period of time up to the present, approximately 2000, and where we have, you know, 4,500 years now of what we might call post-flood geology. And in the post-flood geology, what we now have is a hollow earth with hell at the center. The quotation by, I think I mentioned it the other day, but the quotation by one of the founders of the creationist movement is quite revealing, and for those that you weren't here, I'll just repeat it again. Whenever Hades is referred to in the Bible, it's always down in the earth. This is a quotation now. The depths of the earth. So right there in the center of the earth, apparently, there's a great opening that we can't really deal with in terms of our seismic instruments or other instrumentation. But apparently it is there. You can take the Bible to mean what it says. Now, we have evidence, seismological evidence, that the Earth is in fact a solid core of iron. And that evidence has been corroborated by other types of evidence in the fossil record and the rock record that suggests that the data that we have from seismology is very good. Obviously, we can't go down there and check it out ourselves, but it seems to be a a good bet that we're on the right track and that there's no great void in the middle of the earth. But does anybody know how the Great Flood happened? There is, in fact, in the geological record, evidence for a very, very large flood of what might be called biblical proportions. There's no evidence that it covered the whole earth, but in fact, a very substantial portion of the middle, up near the Caspian Sea. There's evidence in the rock record of that. But anyway, according to the creationists, now there's two options. Now you can pick which one you like best. That the water came from this void in the middle. And now it was first water when the earth was created, right? The waters below, the waters above. The waters above were this atmosphere, Venus-like atmosphere, that all of a sudden just decided to dissipate and let all of its waters completely flood the earth. The other one is the waters below that they just simply welled up and flooded the earth. Which is more popular? Would you say?
40 days and 40 days.
Rain. Just rain. Well, okay. I'm not sure about the Venusian atmosphere, but according to the current data, the atmosphere of Venus is composed of sulfuric acid and carbon dioxide. And so if that was the rain, then that would be pretty rough. Anyway, what I'd like to do is just sort of discuss a little bit I'm certainly not an expert in this area. I think to be an expert in this area, you'd have to kind of spend a lot of time with this creation science. But what I'd like to talk about really is the broader picture and kind of get your input on the sorts of things that you're thinking. And I've got a couple of propositions. And the first of these is on the use of the Bible as a scientific text. How do people feel about that? We believe in the truth of the Bible, don't we? As Christians or people of faith, don't we? How do we believe in the truth of the Bible? What is our feeling of that? I mean, we believe that it's the inspired Word of God, do we not?
It seems like the theologians who are studying it, do accept it as truth as far as a story of faith.
Right.
But I think they also admit that the Bible was formed by people who, were forming committees and chose that this should be included and that should be excluded.
Uh-huh.
And so if you study theology not science, but as a doctrine, that the Bible was, there are parts that were excluded, parts that were included, and the truth that's in it is sort of a universal truth, not scientific truth.
Right.
Do you know that the inclusion or exclusion process was controlled entirely or partly or hardly at all by the Holy Spirit?
No, I wasn't there at those meetings. I don't know how they occurred.
I don't either. I imagine it's a very good story, historically. But I don't know if the record is written down anywhere.
Some of it is, some of it isn't. But the thing is, you must be aware of the line of reasoning which says that God worked through his church to mm-hmm. give us the scriptures that we have now.
Right.
And
always
a debate as to, how precisely and specifically God affected that process.
Of course. I think it's really at the heart of this debate, mm-hmm. really.
Right.
In essence. My take on it, and the use of the Bible as a scientific text, what this group, and I don't want to appear like I'm attacking this group from the point of view of a scientist. I don't want to put that kind of vibe out there, because that's really not what it's about, and I think that'll become clear a little bit later on. But to me, the use of the Bible as a scientific text is seeking some absolute proof in a sacred text which is supposed to engender faith. I mean, the Bible, we read the Bible and we're inspired by the stories in the Gospels and the creation stories and the trials of the people who strove to build faith. But doesn't it seem like this is kind of a disrespectful to the Bible? I mean, would you agree with me on that? That to take it as a scientific text, where it appears to us that it wasn't intended that way, was God intending to deliver science to us through the Bible? I mean, because I think if you agree with this point of view, I think that's what you have to come to the conclusion. That God was intending to deliver the science through the Bible, and that, or maybe not, but it seems to me that if you agree with this type of reasoning, that ultimately God gave us the ability to do scientific inquiry or be thinking people, even without science, but be thinking people, to ultimately come to the conclusion that what is written down in the Bible is absolutely true. Is that the function of science? I guess I have some trouble with that.
Well, don't we get into trouble with wordage and translation and a 24-hour day? How did they know what the day was? The sun hadn't even been created yet, so how do we know it was a day? You know, that's where we get into trouble. But can we look at the overall picture of creation and know that, yes, the heavens were created before vegetation and, you know, man was last? And, you know, we can scientifically look at the Bible and say, yeah, you know, it pretty much makes sense that this is probably basically how things happen as we date them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree with you. I don't think we can take it as a science textbook. But I don't think it defies science either. I think that as we look at, you know, the story of the creation of this happened and this, this, and this, and we go back and we try and we look at what scientifically we think happened, they happen basically pretty much in the same order. So.
Sure, I don't think it's meant to defy science. I think there's a popular perception out there, and personally, I've not run into this in my own life, but there's a popular perception out there is that one of the functions of science is to refute the existence of God. And I've not experienced that, but one of the more senior members of our laboratory told me that is in fact the case, based on a lot of discussion and talking with people about this issue of science literacy today, which is a very important topic, that it's become clear to him that is the case.
That seems strange to me, Steve, because if you and I both know the scientific method, blah, blah, blah. But that seems to me saying, here's the conclusion, now we're going to try to prove it.
Uh-huh.
Sure. That's not to me nonsense.
Yeah, it seems like if you took the Bible as a scientific, you know, as a scientific text, then you have to reverse the scientific process. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to say, here's this, and then you work backwards to prove it. Whereas science, you know, and then you have the theory and you work forward and prove it. So that's how you uncover things like the periodic table, uncover the DNA molecule. Mm-hmm. Is that you have to work forward. So if you're working backwards, then you have to, you know, then you're biased. I mean, it's not a double-blind study. You're skewing the data, which makes it you can't even publish it.
Right.
Let me iterate on something you said the other day, but he's brought the subject back up. This is something that, at least to me, was that people were very curious about where we came from and all that, the universe. Always have asked those questions. The point is that they didn't have the facts that we have today to write it down. And so they wrote down what they believe based on very limited mm-hmm. knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising that maybe there's a difference in the order of things. So what?
I have had a similar experience to what Steve's colleague has said. I'm a physicist, and there are plainly people in my profession. I wouldn't say a majority, but some of them are very vocal and influential, who clearly have an agenda of putting an end to traditional religious faith. And they are attempting to manipulate scientific discovery towards that end. And even perhaps more disturbing is many of these people aren't actually, some of these people are not actually practitioners of the scientific world themselves, the scientific process themselves. There are people who make a living going around giving lectures to this effect, just a few of them. But they are out there. And it is disturbing. I think that's part of why it produces such a heated controversy.
Yeah, I agree. And like I said, I haven't run into anyone like that, although certainly there may be someone like that that I know that I don't necessarily know that about them. But I certainly have no doubt that they are there. And you're right, it is a disturbing development. But why is it disturbing? Why is it disturbing to us to see that? Would you say?
Because I think, well, for me, I think that there is no viable sane society without a concept of God very much as we have in the Jewish, Christian, or Islamic tradition. Mm-hmm. And so that goal, to me, seems very destructive, to put an end to that.
I agree.
And it also is just not justifiable intellectually. You know, mm-hmm. people will go around saying you can't prove God exists, you can't prove he doesn't exist either.
Right, right. It's kind of dishonest. And
Steve, the people that you associate with in the scientific community, do you think those generally are people of faith or generally not?
That's a really good question. I guess I have two different answers. One is that it usually doesn't come up. You know, that your scientific work is of one realm and the faith that people have is of another. But the people that I do know about, I believe, at least in my own experience, that they are people of faith that believe in one particular is fellow is a fairly quite Orthodox Jew, actually, and I've often wanted to discuss this sort of thing with him, but have never sort of had the opportunity to do so. But I think in general, people are people of faith. That the people that I've run into and that carry out scientific work, it does not, they don't have an agenda like what you've said. I have not encountered people like that. I think
most that I've met do not have a sort of I guess you would call a liberal, non-literal form of religious faith is common. Religious faiths which are associated with specific ethnic groups in my environment are treated with respect. It's really just the fundamental Christian that gets heat, at least in the physics community. There was a survey I found out about fraction of scientists with a certain degree of religious belief. And the survey actually was first taken at the turn of the last century, around 19-something, early 1900s. And they found something, I forget what the number is, but a sizable fraction of professional scientists with religious beliefs. and a smaller fraction of the famous, accomplished, successful scientists with religious belief. And what was interesting was the survey was redone 70 or 80 years later, very recently, coming to essentially the same conclusion as to what those fractions were. And I don't remember what the numbers are. They're large fractions, but they're also smaller fractions than the American population as a whole.
One of the things I'm wondering is, you know, you talked, when you started this, you talked about the premise of the of this one group of creationists. And I think, I mean, we all started with, all of us started with different, you know, a variety of different premises, both probably philosophical and scientific. So if faith is not playing an important role in a person's life, then they're going to, even through scientific research, wouldn't that influence their work?
I don't think so. I think the attitude that most people take about it is that it's sort of a subconscious attitude that you can't allow your own beliefs to interfere with what you are working on scientifically. And for most people, that doesn't come up. You know, for example, for me, I don't work on issues like this. And so I'm more concerned about the actual chemical reactions and the processes that are going on, as opposed to the age or the dating and the organization of layers of the earth. And so my work does not, like I said before, it never comes up. Yeah. It's just I can't imagine a time in my own work where it would actually come up. I've just chose a different path that, not intentionally of course, but that does not cross this kind of boundary. I don't know if your work does.
Not the work part. I get involved also with education and outreach activities, and there does,
right,
the conversation does appear.
Right, right. So I guess that's the answer. And so in some ways, I guess it's difficult for someone like me to talk about it, because on the one hand, I have a fairly good, comfortable coexistence going on with the science that I'm a part of, which is certainly this. I'm certainly a part of it as studying earth science, but also having a place for faith that, and as I mentioned yesterday, it's my own personal view of it, and it may not jive with others, but is that there's some divine intelligence that set this whole thing rolling. And that's the creation story, that we've been allowed to have the ability to put these pieces together, to discover whether it's the macroscopic or the history of the earth that God has created, or whether it's like the physicist who uncovers the physical laws that govern these. I guess that's my take on it, you know, and that may be helpful or not helpful. But the question that I have too, another question that I have is the following: what type of faith is it that seeks to prove these points? Is that faith?
Maybe this is not really a scientific exercise. Maybe this is a theological exercise.
Well, I think in the end, you're right. When you finally go back to the, you know, to the beginning of anything, you know, you're...
By definition of faith, having to have something proven to you, that's not faith. You know, faith is
right.
Accepting things that can't be proven. So if you
right.
need, if you need a religion and a creation that can be absolutely scientifically proven, I question that that's faith.
I have a question that I wrote to myself when I was thinking about this. If this is the character of a certain type of faith, that is to say, that one takes the Bible as a literal text, a scientific text, and that's not, those aren't my words now, those are the words of the creationist movement, is that the Bible may be considered as a scientific text. If we if that is the character of a faith, then, and you have to have something proven to you, like this, the story of creation has its concrete, absolute character, then what's going to happen to that faith when it has to deal with something very difficult that can't be proven? For example, if what is going to happen to that faith in the face of uncertainty when it has to confront something like what we've come to know as the Holocaust, for example, where 6 to 8 million innocent people died as a result of terror between 1941 and 1945. That's the question that I have. Can a faith that has to have this kind of concrete proof to be comfortable in that faith, is it going to be able to tackle the hard issues? Or is that not relevant?
I think there are many creationists who are Dietrich Bonhoeffer fans. Quite possibly.
I don't dispute that, but how is that possible?
Why is it impossible?
Well, I guess I just go back to my question, is that, you know, there's issues in the world that we face, I think, that require our faith to deal with. And part of our faith is a certain element of doubt, as you point out. I mean, you can't have faith without doubt. But yet, if there's a character, if one of the characters of your faith has to be concrete, like, for instance, in the creation of the earth, or the creation story, the age of the earth, these kinds of things, doesn't it follow then that one should be able to find the rationale or the reason why for something like the Holocaust in some kind of way, some kind of concrete reason for the existence of that?
I'm not sure it does. And even if it does, you know, there are some kind of reasonings, you know, with that kind of reasoning you can prove anything.
Yeah.
All right. A creationist might, for instance, take the point of view that the Bible does speak of Satan and does speak of the prince of this world and does refer to the evil created by powerful people. And a creationist could easily see a manifestation of that in the horrors of the Second World War and in all wars.
But would that be faith? I mean, would that be...
That's not an expression of the view that God is triumphant and instantly triumphant in every individual situation, but it's a rationalization, a way of saying that even horrible things happen in a framework that can be explained scripturally. What I'm saying is, yeah. I think, you know, there are certain lines of reasoning you can use and you can explain anything, and this might be such a lot.
But that's, I think that's part of my point, that I think most people who look at an event like that will say that it, on one level, yes, there's a certain sequence of events, and yes, these events happen to cause this immense tragedy. But on another level, I think most people looking at that realize that that is something that just cannot be explained. And just on another level, on a sort of a higher level than just the actual historical evidence. Yeah.
I think he's right, though, because if you look at what happened in the Third Reich, the Confessing Church was primarily made of the more conservative of the theologians, and the ones that were more liberal tend to become part of what was called the German Christians. Mm-hmm. And even somebody like Tillich, who was certainly a liberal theologian and one of the first chucked out of the university, when he, the difference between volume one of the systematic theology and volume two is the Second World War happens, and in volume two, evil exists. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense of, I mean, I don't mind the creationist science author, but there is a sense about being able to stand firm mm-hmm. under incredible pressure mm-hmm. That one has to admire. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at some of the confessing church people at that period of time, you've got Dietrich Bonhoeffer or you've got Barth and people like that, they are the more conservative brand. They might have come up with some form of science like this, but they do tend to be on the more conservative branch and do talk about the reality of evil.
Yeah, to me, okay, I mean, there are different ways of thinking of what science is. For me, science has always been the interrogation of the book of creation by experiment and discovery, with some compiled understanding of what those experiments mean. And this is not such an exercise. Mm-hmm. I mean, science is fundamentally a very anti-authoritarian exercise, and this is, at its outset, an authoritarian point of view. The answers are in this book, you just mm-hmm. have to read it. And so, to me, it seems that creationism is actually a theological exercise in trying to push a specific scriptural interpretation as far as possible. And so I wonder if there's an interesting question, you know, why are you trying to do that? And I think it has a lot to do with how the church and different parts of our church and our society approach the scripture. I think how much authority we let the scripture have over our lives is, you know, sort of the central theological debate since the time of Martin Luther. Mm-hmm. And this is one extreme approach that we must take every single word in its simplest, most literal form.
Yeah, you have a comment?
Well, I'm certainly neither a geologist nor a physicist. I am a psychologist. But I hear some of what you're saying, not dealing with the good and evil and not going into the example that you gave, but you mentioned a moment ago looking at the scientific method and looking at, in effect, how could people view something in a certain kind of way, at least I thought I heard you moving in that direction, and attempting to be gracious and say, I don't want to be against that, but how does that happen? And to some degree, I think you moved into personality, and people can believe whatever they have to believe mm-hmm. to make their own gestalt work.
Right.
And they mm-hmm. will believe whatever. And I don't say that in a pejorative way. I say that's what most of us do to survive, because we live in a crazy world. Mm-hmm. And people can totally accept something, and if it doesn't quite work, they'll figure out how to make it work and grab some data to make that particular thing work. And I'm not saying that to disagree with what you're saying, but I am taking that one piece of what you said. How could anyone do this piece and believe that?
Right.
Because that's in their own personality construct, that's what they have to do. And it's interesting in the overall context, I have a difficult time doing this, but maybe one of my jobs is to be as inclusive of someone who has a belief system that is that limited in my way of thinking, but I'm sure they look at my belief system and say I'm limited. So to be right. inclusive and say, well, that's what you need to do right now and I'll look at it. And so, but I think a little bit of what you did was moved into the whole personality makeup, and
right.
that's how they believe.
Well,
that's how I believe.
Right, and the question I asked was just that, a question. It was in my own way to, you know, explore the topic that certainly is not an expertise. So I understand that point, and that you know clears up a lot of things for me. At least the discussion that we've had. I guess in the end, what I'm trying to get to here is to think about the way in which one needs to approach this, the problem that exists, and not a problem in the, a difficulty, but a problem in the scientific sense that's something that needs to be addressed and solved eventually. For example, as I've said before, I live in Virginia, and recently the idea of prayer in public schools has become a hot topic there. And believe it or not, it comes up always. You know, it's constantly in public debate. But recently there was passed by the state legislature, which is overwhelmingly Republican. As a matter of fact, we lost last November our last statewide Democratic elected representative. Now there are no more statewide Democratic elected people at all in Virginia. Chuck Robb was in the Senate and lost to George Allen by a fairly, I guess it depends on where you are. We thought it was a pretty hefty margin. But anyway, he lost. The person who beat him, George Allen, was instrumental, really, during his term as governor of Virginia in instituting the standards of learning type of educational model. And now it's a fact in Virginia, and it's universally disliked, I think, by teachers. But part of that also is this idea that there ought to be a moment of silence at the beginning of the school day for all children, grades K through 12. And that is a fact now. It is a state law that there is to be a moment of silence in the classroom. A minute, 1 minute, where students are urged to reflect, to, I think the language to pray was not in the law, but for silent meditation and contemplation or some language like that. So anyway, my, son has to deal with that. And it seems to me that part of this debate that's entering into the public schools, this debate about a moment of silence is sort of chipping away at a separation of the religious realm and the public realm, whether it's the scientific realm or just the educational realm in general, that seems to me to be helpful in our country. It seems to me that it's healthy that we have a separation between the church and the state. That is to say, we don't necessarily want to have a disclaimer in the front of our child's textbook that says the theory of evolution is a controversial theory.
But isn't that the truth? Don't we get that controversy every day in our newspapers?
It is, but do we need to also have creation science as an alternative to that controversy? Is that something that we want in the public school? And I don't have the answers to that. I mean, that's part of what I've been trying to get at this week, is just that, is that, what is the resolution? Where should the Christian church, or the church in general, or the community of faith, I guess, stand on that issue? I think it's something that we all need to think about. I mean, my son has a very interesting way of dealing with the moment of silence. He brings a book in the morning, and when he's getting his materials all ready, he opens it up to the page that he wants, and then when they're supposed to have a moment of silence, he slips the book out and he starts reading. That's his way of dealing with the moment of silence. I said, all right, fine, you can do that, just don't put the book on the desk. Okay? I'll back you up no matter what you do, as long as you just don't go in the teacher's face with it.
I'm an elementary school teacher, and the opposite has happened in the nation, where a student brings a Bible to read during silent reading time and gets sort of reprimanded by the teacher. So there is, it's a question of where, how do we achieve this, the interaction of academic discipline with faith. You
know, right.
How do you achieve that outside? It's not an easy thing to do.
Right, it's not easy. And one of the things that I've tried to do this week, I suppose with varying degrees of success, is to put that issue out there. And, you know, some, at least in particular, this issue of the age of the earth, where very well established scientific principles, I mean, it's true that the theory of evolution is very controversial. The theory of the age of the earth really is not, and in a scientific sense, and that it's also part of the goal on the part of people who are in the community of faith. It's part of their goal to displace this, at least from its position of, quote, authority, or its prime position as something that's taught, and to replace it or to add on the creation science as an alternative, and that it's mandated that the public school teach this. To me, that seems very dangerous, and it's confusing to kids.
Well, I think to teach creation science without teaching the entire theological framework that it comes from is kind of like, you know, having the the whipped cream without the apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're missing a large section of the whole viewpoint. And I do think, to me, the interesting question is, as you pointed out, I mean, there are reasons why people take this point of view. I mean, it is a crazy world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
My own point of view is, I think that there's no, you know, viable ethical society without a concept of God, which this could be. I mean, this is the only such concept of God that creates a viable society.
That's true.
And certainly a society with no God, well, if you have a school with no God and the school is part of your society, that's something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the only threat I see to this, I mean, if they want to believe that, that's their right mm-hmm. to do that. I think the threat comes in imposing that on us or the schools. And so I think if you want to enter into a debate with them and show them your data versus their data on one-on-one, that's one thing, but for them to come and say, now this has to be taught, then that's something else. And I don't think we're going to fight that battle by proving whose data is the best.
Right.
You know, I think we're going to have to fight the battle on a totally different level. It's like, you know, getting the gangster on tax evasion rather than on what he did.
Right.
I think we're going to have to fight it on, you know, this is the purpose of the school, this is the purpose of the church, this is the purpose of that, and just leave what they think is right, what we think is right, out of it and go at it from a whole different approach.
Right. I think in the end that was my goal, at least, to bring the point up and to suggest, I think, that that we do need to at least resolve some way of looking at the problem and what's going to be the best way for a coherent sort of vision of what we view as the place of science and how it illuminates the creation as opposed to proves one version of it, I guess.
Like in the state of Oregon, you know, we have a what they call a Christian coalition of some sort or another, led by Les Maybaum, who's trying to get a lot of things into, schools and everything else. And the only way he's been defeated is just not on his ideas, but saying, okay, but that's unconstitutional. You know, you have to, you have to go through the back door sometimes.
Yeah.
And not even head on with what his beliefs are.
Right, right. The point of this this article that I referred to in this Flood Geology was that that scientists need to fight the battle against this. And their view is that it's just bad science. It's just wrong, and it's bad science, and that it's being put out as science, and it's an affront to the scientific community that people actually are calling this science, and that needs to be addressed. It's kind of a minor point that that this is showing up in local school boards all over the country, and that people who are, you know, very well trained at the public relations aspect of putting this out there for consideration are not being answered by scientists in the right way. That scientists are on the defensive, and that you need to go on the offensive and make them defend the totality of the model as opposed to refute little points of view. And I think that's kind of along the lines of what you were saying. If you try to each little point that you make, those points get lost in the overall picture, I think. But also, I think you were also saying, and I'll close with this, is that the issue is much broader, and that attacking it from purely the scientific point of view may not be the most profitable way of proceeding.
Yeah. I mean, there's another aspect which we haven't discussed, which is that a young Earth point of view is also almost always an anti-evolutionary point of view, mm-hmm. that our understanding of evolution is that it is a random process, or at least an apparently random process, and that our role as human beings is being created in God's image is a purposeful act. Mm-hmm. And it is hard to understand how an apparently random process can be part of God's immediate purpose. It's not impossible, mm-hmm. but it's hard.
Right.
All right. So perhaps what we're looking at here when we're discussing a piece of geological science, it's not just a problem in geological science. It's also a problem in biology, and it is also a problem in theology, and therefore a problem in how we construct our society. Mm-hmm. And that, maybe there are some real conflicts here between some at least straightforward interpretations of what we've seen scientifically and what we really need to make a just world.
That's an excellent point.
I would have to agree kind of with Leo, said that it takes an enormous amount more faith in my mind to believe in evolution than it does to believe that there was some sort of creation. You know,
especially since both have just been told to you by authority
figures.
Exactly.
But my real question was, and maybe this is more for the educators, but are we in danger? Are the textbooks being printed at this as we speak with this in it, or is it still? Are we still on the cusp of seeing this in there? I mean, are there things in print that our children are giving as textbooks that say?
It's, well, there are examples of it out there. This article, let's see, where is it? There is a book out there. This is a paper that was written by a colleague on addressing some of these issues. In the book called Dumping on Darwin, Michael Lemonick considers Pat Buchanan's denunciation of teaching children evolutionary theory and surmises that nearly half of Americans deny Darwin's theory against all scientific evidence. He also points out that all biology textbooks in Alabama have a disclaimer stating that evolution is a, quote, controversial theory, and that school boards in Washington and Ohio recently considered adopting a textbook called Of Pandas and People, which contradicted known science on virtually every page. That's a review from Time magazine. Recent polls suggest that nearly half of all Americans and Canadians reject Darwin's theory in favor of Genesis 1 and 2. So they're out there. The books are out there. They're being written. They're being printed and certainly can be adopted by schools that are not public schools.
But are they being written as that strict of a viewpoint? Are they being written as a more liberal creationist view of this is generally what is taught in the Bible as opposed to what's taught in science?
That I don't know for sure. According to my understanding, the books themselves are out there that support the creationist viewpoint and give it, that is the subject of the book, that is the scientific thrust of that book, is to prove, to use scientific data to prove that Genesis 1 and 2 is the story of creation. I think that in general, you're not going to get a reputable publisher to publish that book in terms of a textbook publisher, for example, for, you know, elementary school or whatever, but they are out there, definitely, yeah.
I don't see it as the threat that you were asking the question about. In Washington State, I know a fellow, and interestingly enough, I guess we come with their biases, it comes back with his personality. He's a former world-class athlete, he's articulate, he's winsome, and his very conservative evolutionist kind of mentality that he wants, he demands the right and is doing everything he can legislatively and everywhere else in Washington State to say that there be a two-track and you have the option as to which one you get to study. And he hasn't had a lot of success, but that's what his life commitment is to. He runs a little computer business. That's to sort of keep the money coming in. He's a bright man, and he is wanting that two-track in the state of Washington so that every child and every parent has the choice of which one they want to go. And interestingly enough, and I call him a friend of mine, and I think it's interesting, and I like to have discussions with him, and I tell him he's full of baloney, but we laugh about it, you know. But the point is, he's not having a lot of success either.
Mm-hmm.
A little, right? I mean, you know, there are some people listening, but if threat is the right word that I hear somewhat in this room, I don't think he's a real threat.
I have to say I'm glad that half of America doesn't believe what they get told in school. It's personal. I like my skepticism.
That's a good point. Maybe that's where we ought to stop. I thank you again for your insight and coming along to these sessions. It's, as I said, it's a new endeavor for me, and the insight that you've provided has been very valuable. So thanks for coming, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with me. Go back to your local school boards and battle it out.